Pull up a chair. I want to take you back to a hangar in Wichita, Kansas, in the summer of 1929. The doors are shut in the middle of a heat wave. There's a guard posted, and inside, under a tarp, sits an airplane that nobody outside a handful of men is allowed to see. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and this is the hangar, the place where we sit with a cup of coffee and talk about the airplanes that mattered. Today we're talking about a little ship that didn't have a proper name for most of its life. The newspapers just called it the mystery ship. And by the end of one afternoon in Cleveland, it made the United States Army and the United States Navy look like they'd shown up to the wrong fight. Now here's where it gets interesting, and I'll get to the good part. The part where a farm state monoplane humiliates the fastest military pursuit planes in the country. But first, let me set the table. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And this next story, well, it's the kind you'd want a coin for. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So 1929, you have to understand what the world looked like. This was the golden age of air racing. Back when aviation was cheap and airspace was free, and the fastest airplanes in America weren't in the military. They were owned by oil companies and built by little manufacturers who were fighting for their lives in the newspaper headlines. Because in those days, speed sold airplanes. If your ship won the races in September, you sold airplanes in the spring. It was that simple. Winning wasn't vanity. Winning was payroll. And the big showdown every year was the National Air Races. In 1929, they were held in Cleveland, Ohio, out at the airport there, in front of grandstands packed with 100,000 people. People came in from all over the Midwest, in their Sunday clothes, to stand in the sun and watch airplanes tear around a closed course marked by pylons. Big checkered towers stuck out in a farm field. You'd fly around them low and flat and hang the airplane on its wingtip in the turns. Now, the marquee event was the free-for-all, unlimited, anything goes, and for years that race had belonged to the military. The Army and the Navy would show up with their frontline pursuit ships, their Curtis Hawks, biplanes with big geared engines and government money behind them, and they would clean house. A civilian didn't beat the military. That was just the natural order of things. The military had the engines, the budgets, and the test pilots. Everybody knew it. Everybody except a company called Travel Air. Travel Air was a Wichita outfit. It had been started a few years earlier by three names you might know if you love this stuff. Walter Beach, Lloyd Stearman, and Clyde Cessna. Yeah, that Beach, that Stearman, that Cessna, all three of them under one roof before they went off and built the companies that carried their own names. By 1929, Stearman and Cessna had already moved on, and Walter Beach was running the show, and Travel Air mostly built good, honest, open cockpit biplanes, mail planes, sport planes, sturdy stuff for a sturdy market. Nobody thought of Travel Air as a speed shop, but Beach had two young engineers, fellows named Herb Rodden and Walter Burnham, and they came to him with an idea. Let us build a racer, a real one, a clean monoplane, low wing, everything fared in, everything smooth, and let's go to Cleveland and see what we can do. And Beach, who understood that a headline in September paid the bills all winter, told them to go do it, quietly. And that's the part I love. They did it quietly. They built it behind closed doors on their own time, mostly at night after the regular work was done. They kept the drawings locked up. When they rolled it out to test it, they'd do it early, before the field got busy. The whole town knew Travel Air was up to something out there, but nobody could get a good look at it. And a reporter, not knowing what else to call the thing, wrote it up as the Travel Air Mystery Ship. The name stuck, and honestly, it was a better name than anything the engineers would have come up with. Let me tell you what they actually built, because if you love airplanes the way I do, the shape of this thing will make you smile. It was a low-wing monoplane at a time when nearly everything fast was still a biplane. It had a wire-braced wing, thin and clean. The fuselage was fared in smooth, all the lumps and bumps smoothed over, and up front they wrapped the engine in one of the new NACA cowlings. Now that's the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, NACA, the outfit that eventually became NASA. And they just figured out that if you put a properly shaped ring cowling around a radial engine, you cut the drag way down and you actually cool the engine better at the same time. It was one of the great free lunches in aviation history, and Travel Air grabbed it. They even put pants on the wheels. Little teardrop fairings over the landing gear, what we'd call wheel spats. Every place the wind could grab the airplane, they gave it something smooth to slide over instead. Under that cowling was a right radial, and by race trim, depending on which account you read, that little ship was doing north of 235 miles an hour in level flight. Some say faster. To put that in your pocket, the frontline military pursuit planes of the day, the ones with the government behind them were running right around that same number, or a touch slower. A farm state company, working nights, had just built an airplane that ran with the United States military, and they had a pilot to fly it, a fellow named Doug Davis. Now, Doug Davis was a Georgia boy, a barnstormer turned airline man, the kind of pilot who'd flown everything and been scared by most of it and kept flying anyway. He knew how to pull an airplane around a pylon, and when they handed him the mystery ship, he understood exactly what he had in his hands. So they trucked it to Cleveland, and when they pulled the covers off at the field, you can imagine the muttering in the grandstands and along the flight line. The military pilots, the Army and Navy men in their sharp uniforms, standing next to their government ships, looking over at this smooth little monoplane from Wichita that nobody had been allowed to photograph, wondering what in the world Travelair thought it was doing, showing up to the free-for-all. They were about to find out. Here's where it gets interesting. They line up for the free-for-all, the unlimited race, everybody's fastest ship, and the gun goes, and they're off around the pylons, low and flat and loud, that pack of airplanes hauling around the course with the crowd on its feet, and Doug Davis in the mystery ship just walks away from them, not by a little. He pulls out front and he keeps pulling. The military ships are back there doing everything they can, and the smooth little monoplane from Kansas is out in clean air by itself, the crowd's going crazy. This isn't supposed to happen. The civilian isn't supposed to lead the Army and the Navy around the pylons, like they're tied to a post. But then, and this is the moment, on one of the turns, Doug Davis cuts a pylon. Now let me explain what that means, because it's the whole drama of the thing. On a closed course pylon race, you have to go around the outside of each pylon. You round it. If you cut inside it, if you turn too tight and clip the corner, you've cheated the course and you're disqualified. Simple as that. And Davis, flying that hot little ship as hard as it would go, came around one pylon and shaved it too close. Cut the inside of it. Now, nobody made him do anything. He was out front. He was winning by a country mile. He could have kept right on going, and there's a real chance that judges never flag it in all that dust and noise. And he takes the trophy home, and the Army goes back to the barracks embarrassed. But Doug Davis knew he'd cut it. And he did the thing that tells you everything about the man. He hauled that airplane around, went back and rerounded the pylon the right way. Gave back all that distance. Threw away the lead he'd built, deliberately, so that when he crossed the line there'd be no asterisk on it. So that nobody in that Navy uniform could ever say the civilian only won because he cheated the corner. And then he put his head down and did it all over again. Ran the rest of the course and won the thing clean. Averaged, by the record books, something close to 194 miles an hour over the whole race. Going back and fixing his own mistake in the middle of it. Beat the Army, beat the Navy, beat all of them, honest with a pylon correction thrown in for free. Pull that image up in your mind, 100,000 people on their feet in a farm field in Ohio. A little smooth monoplane nobody had been allowed to photograph, from a company most folks thought only built biplanes, out in front of the fastest military airplanes in America, and the pilot's so sure of his ship that he can afford to give back a lead to keep his honor clean. That's the golden age right there. That's the whole thing in one afternoon. Now the fallout was exactly what Walter Beach had been betting on. The mystery ship was on the front page. Travelair couldn't have bought that kind of advertising. The whole country suddenly knew that the fast airplanes might not be coming out of the military hangars anymore. They might be coming out of Wichita, out of little companies with young engineers working nights. And that message wasn't lost on the men in uniform either. There's a lesson buried in that race that the Army and the Navy took to heart over the next few years. The clean monoplane, the smooth cowling, the retractable and faired gear, the attention to every square inch of drag, that was the future. The open cockpit biplanes days were numbered, and the national air races were where a lot of people saw it happen first, out loud, in front of a grandstand. The racers were dragging the whole industry forward, one September at a time. They only built a handful of these mystery ships, five give or take, depending on how you count them. They weren't a production airplane. They were flying billboards, and they were record setters. One of them went to the Texas company, to Texaco, painted up in that company's colors, and Frank Hawks flew it back and forth across the country, setting transcontinental speed records, coast to coast, faster than anybody thought a single engine airplane had any business going. These little ships kept rewriting the record book for years after Cleveland, but I'll tell you the part that sits heavy, because our stories from this era so often carry it. Doug Davis, the man who gave back the lead to keep his wind clean, was killed a few years later, 1934, at the National Air Races, the very races that made his name. He was flying another airplane hard around the pylons the way he always did, and he lost it in a turn and went in. The pylon racing of the Golden Age was glorious and it was brutal, and it took a lot of the best of them. These men flew with a margin that would put your heart in your throat, wingtip down in the turns, wide open, feet from the ground, and every year the sport collected its debt from somebody. So when we talk about the golden age, I don't want to hand you just the shiny part. The smooth little airplane and the roaring crowd. That's real. But so is the price. Those pilots knew the odds and they went out and flew anyway, because they believed the airplane was going somewhere and they wanted to be the ones who took it there. Dub Davis rounding back to fix his pylon is the same man, the same code, that eventually cost him. He flew all the way to the edge on purpose. That was the whole point. You can still see a Travel Air mystery ship if you go looking. There are a couple of them left, an original and some faithful reproductions. And now and then one of them fires up that right radial and rounds a pylon at a modern air show. And for a minute or two, you get to hear exactly what 100,000 people heard in Cleveland in 1929. That smooth little shape, low and fast and honest, coming around the corner with the whole future of aviation tucked up under its cowling. That's the sound I chase. That's why I still go stand at the fence. My thanks to the folks who keep this history straight, the record keepers at the National Air Races Archives, and the good work over the years in the pages of Air and Space and the Wichita Aviation Histories that keep the Travel Air story alive. If you want to dig into any of it, come find us at radiohangar.com and I'll point you toward the good stuff. I'm Tail Dragger. Next time somebody tells you the civilians never could have kept up with the military, you tell them about a little ship from Kansas built at night that gave back its lead just to win the right way. See you next time.